I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is running a TV ad in Pennsylvania condemning Democrat Hillary Clinton's statement Friday in which she characterized half of Trump supporters as deplorables. WHYY's Dave Davies reports.
In case you missed it, here's how Clinton defined the deplorables.
The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
Clinton later regretted saying half of Trump supporters are deplorable, but says Trump has encouraged and empowered people with extreme views. Trump's TV ad, which is running in four battleground states, is not subtle.
Speaking to wealthy donors, Hillary Clinton called tens of millions of Americans deplorable. People like you, you, and you. You know what's deplorable? Hillary Clinton viciously demonizing hardworking people like you.
Clinton's comments are being compared to Mitt Romney saying 47% of Americans live off the government and will never support him, and Barack Obama saying in 2008 that many economically stressed people cling to guns and religion. It's a rule of thumb in politics that you can criticize policies and opponents, but you don't attack voters. It's fair to note Trump has tread that ground before.
How stupid are the people of Iowa?
How's the controversy playing in Pennsylvania? WHYY called a sampling of voters from the most recent Franklin and Marshall poll. A little more than half were aware of Clinton's comments, and reactions broke along partisan lines. Victor Klepfer of Armstrong County is a registered Democrat and Trump supporter.
I don't like to be called names. It's going to hurt her. She's going to lose a lot of votes over this.
Mary Mando is a registered nurse from McCain, Pennsylvania, near Erie, and a Clinton supporter.
I agree with her. It seems to me that a lot of them are mostly a lot of bigots. Yeah.
Will Clinton's gaffe affect her standing among the state's independents and undecideds? Terry Madonna directs the Franklin and Marshall poll.
We don't know yet. It's going to take probably a good week until we learn in public opinion polls whether it's made a difference. But it certainly can't help.
Meanwhile, the Clinton campaign has a new ad quoting prominent Republicans, including Romney, harshly criticizing Trump. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Last February, Harry Levant, a well-connected Philadelphia attorney, confessed to stealing $2 million from clients and then spending it all on his gambling habit. The judge allowed Levant to avoid jail time so that he could work to pay back his former clients. But as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, Levant is scheduled to be back in court this week for missing restitution payments.
Harry Levant, who's now been disbarred, admitted to pocketing money from more than a dozen clients, including a family member. He forged their signatures on checks, took money out of client escrow accounts, and squandered it all away at casinos. His victims included a double amputee who lost her home and a family member whose life savings he spent on gambling. Prosecutors say the mass theft began in 2012, shortly after Levant unsuccessfully ran for judge in Philadelphia. At a sentencing hearing, witnesses included State Representative Dwight Evans, a family friend. Evans testified that Levant is a good guy. Levant's defense attorney argued that gambling is just as addictive as crack. Prosecutors asked that Levant spend a couple years behind bars. Common Pleas Judge Edward Wright immediately paroled him and put him on probation for 8 years.
It really changed my perception of the justice system.
Attorney Nick Giuliano represented two of Levant's victims in a separate arbitration dispute.
And it's just an aberration to see someone who's an attorney, just like a stockbroker or someone's in a position of trust, to betray that trust and wipe out someone's life savings and really never have to go to jail. It's a travesty of justice.
Levant's defense team emphasized that he turned himself in before prosecutors were on to him. One of the main reasons the judge said he wasn't giving Levant any time behind bars was so that he could get a job and pay back his victims. But on Wednesday, Levant has a court date over missed payments. Though the original sentencing hearing happened more than a year ago, the case has generated almost no public attention. Tariq El-Shabazz, who represented Levant, now works for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. And after the sentencing hearing, Levant's sister-in-law was hired as chief of staff in the DA's office. So to avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest, the Philly DA's office handed the case to prosecutors in Delaware County. Levant's victims have been invited to the hearing. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
For years, advocates railing against Pennsylvania's educational funding system have argued that the state relies too much on local tax dollars, putting poor districts at a disadvantage. And tomorrow, those advocates get their day in court. A group of students and districts has sued the state, alleging its funding scheme violates their constitutional right to a proper education. More from WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
At a City Hall sing-in, a choir for the Girard Academic Music Program in South Philadelphia broke out a Little Carol King. And with that, they set the stage for a case that could shake Pennsylvania's educational landscape. For advocates like Donna Cooper of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, the case before the Supreme Court is a matter of simple fairness.
That's why we're here, to remind them what this court case is about. They're going to hear a lot of mumbo-jumbo from the legislature and the governor. This case is about the future of Pennsylvania.
Of course, that mumbo-jumbo will be crucial to determining the victor. Now, the big picture argument here is that Pennsylvania's funding system shortchanges students in poor districts and violates the state's constitutional guarantees of a thorough and efficient education system for all. Michael Churchill represents the plaintiffs.
Those are the facts that we say we will prove at trial. Please let us get to that trial.
Tuesday's Supreme Court case is to determine whether judges should even get involved. Churchill says yes, the gross inequities demand action. Patrick Northen, who is representing the General Assembly in this case, says no. Education funding is the job of the governor and the legislature. If judges get involved, you're blurring the separation of powers and asking for a headache.
And where do you draw the line? What percentage of students scoring what results on a test do you need to separate between a constitutional and unconstitutional education system? There's just no way of managing it.
Twice before, Pennsylvania courts have sided with Northen's position, as recently as 1999. But there have been big changes since then. For one,
the legislature has adopted a very thorough system of standards and definitions of what is a necessary education in the state.
Plus, the state has also developed a slew of new tests to determine whether students are meeting those standards. The plaintiffs say that with all these new objective tools, the judges won't be forced to make a judgment call anymore.
Our claim is there is no policy decision necessary at this point.
Northen and his co-counselors disagree.
The standards didn't just fall out of the sky. There have been standards in Pennsylvania for a long time. There have always been educational standards, and now that the standards are different, that doesn't mean that they're susceptible to being judicially managed.
This case has made for odd political bedfellows. Many of the advocates supporting the plaintiffs tend to be skeptical of new academic standards and standardized tests. And yet those tests are the linchpin of the fair funding argument. On the flip side, Governor Tom Wolf is siding with the GOP-led General Assembly. Wolf's spokesman, Jeff Sheridan, says it's a matter of principle.
This particular matter is about whether or not the court should be deciding how much funding should go to schools, and we don't believe that it should. The governor and the General Assembly should be deciding that, and the governor is going to continue to ask for more funding.
So far, the courts have sided with the state. If the plaintiffs prevail, they win the right to a full trial, weighing whether Pennsylvania is fulfilling its constitutional mandate to provide a thorough and efficient public education. Until then, the debate rages on, in the courtroom and out.
What do we want? When do we want it?
Now. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Almost 4 of 10 Americans reside in coastal communities. And those coastlines are, to varying degrees, increasingly vulnerable to devastated flooding. Let's learn more with Phyllis Cutno, director of the Flood Prepared Communities Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. President Barack Obama is continuing to draw attention to the dangers of rising coastlines and the subsequent funding that's attendant with that, with Baton Rouge as a recent example. Phyllis, discuss the dangers as we know them now in 2016 and where we're likely heading.
Right. Well, Baton Rouge, it's interesting because Baton Rouge is actually going to be, it's on track to be the 4th most costly flooding event in our nation's history. And of course, Pennsylvania, you have some experience both with the Johnstown flood and of course with Agnes. If you live through an event like that, you know that flooding is, not just a nuisance, although it can be a nuisance, but it really is oftentimes a matter of life and death and should be taken very seriously. And flooding is our most common natural disaster. It is also our most costly natural disaster, and it's something that we've really got to plan for in the future if we're going to protect both people and their property from these events that are becoming ever more frequent.
And you cited Baton Rouge and, of course, Louisiana's double-cursed Katrina. And New Orleans, of course, though, is famously under sea level, but we're talking about communities well above sea level that are vulnerable. It was in 1968 that the National Flood Insurance Program was created. Describe its intent back then and how it's functioning now.
The National Flood Insurance Program is a program that provides flood insurance to Americans. It is administered by FEMA. And simply put, they're in the insurance business because at the time that it was conceived, private insurers had really left the business of supplying flood insurance to policyholders. So there are more than 5 million policies, give or take, that Americans hold through the National Flood Insurance Program. There are 22,000 communities that participate, and there are more than 5 million people that purchase flood insurance through the National Flood Insurance Program.
And when a flood comes through, what can that program offer?
So you can insure up to a certain amount for both your property and the contents. And it's really proposed to protect Americans and help them understand their flood risk and mitigate against it. You know, we're really focused on a part of the National Flood Insurance Program which has kind of an outsized impact. And these are kind of called repeatedly flooded properties. So these repeatedly flooded properties are exactly what they sound like. They are properties that have been flooded over and over again and rebuilt. Historically, they've been about 1% of the policies, but they've been roughly a third or more of the claims. Currently, the National Flood Insurance Program is $23 billion in debt, and if you look at the cost of these repeatedly flooded properties, they're about $12 billion of that debt. So these properties are the ones that we really think Congress should be looking at when they reauthorize that program, as they have to do by September of next year.
What are the options that readily come to mind?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things you can do. First of all, you as a homeowner could take a buyout. So for instance, there's a home in Mississippi that's been filed 34 claims over 32 years. You know, the value of the house is $69,000, but it's had $665,000 in flood claims. If you're that person, you might want to say, gosh, it's time for me just to take a buyout and leave this property and move somewhere else. But there are also things that the community can do, address stormwater drainage problems. I mean, that's something that Philadelphia has done very well and has been a high priority in kind of how they are addressing flood risk in Philadelphia. I mean, I think Philadelphia is doing important things. They're developing flood and storage system impacts models for sewer systems and allowing those sewer systems to be appropriately targeted for mitigation action. They're trying to improve drainage into streams and tributaries. They're evaluating structures and floodplains to make sure that they're requiring kind of the right materials that are permeable. You know, they're trying to limit development adjacent to kind of natural developments and natural areas. And they're really trying to map where these repeatedly flooded properties are and try to mitigate against them. So I think, you know, Philadelphia has a good plan that they're working towards, steps that they're taking at kind of all different levels, whether or not it's smart development or working with these repeatedly flooded properties or managing, you know, kind of water and storm surge. And so that's, I think, a smart approach.
Phyllis, thanks so much for bringing us up to date on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Phyllis Kutno, Director of Flood Prepared Communities Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Over the weekend, more than 150 homeless veterans from our region gathered for Philadelphia Stand Down. The three-day retreat offers checkups, live music, and a chance to connect with the VA for services. It's called Bucks County Home for the past 8 years, but it may need a new one for next year. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Kyrie Greenberg reports.
Like the people it has served, Philadelphia Stand Down has had many homes in 23 years. It first set up camp at the Lighthouse Field in Northeast Philly, then moved to the Armory and VA Hospital for a few years. It has been held in Levittown for 8 years. Volunteer Bruce Fritz found the group back when he was homeless. Stand Down now serves about a tenth of the people it once did, and Fritz hopes that indicates there are fewer veterans in need. Shouting over the live music, he says for those who remain, Stand Down brings the VA to vets, not the other way around.
Well, what it is like when you're going through a hardship, it's like you normally are down on yourself. So we have everything in one place instead of like telling someone, okay, you got to go to Wiskasket Avenue, you got to go to the VA hospital, this and that. When they come here, there's other professionals and everybody else to help the vet right there on site.
The Bucks County Commissioners released a statement saying they have new year-round plans for the 130-acre plot and aren't able to host the event in 2017. Stand Down is gathering signatures for a petition asking the county to reconsider. Executive Director Ed Speller says most participants aren't locals and are usually bused in from Philadelphia and Chester counties. So he wonders if that made it a low priority for the county. The commissioner's statement doesn't address that. Undersecretary of the Army Patrick Murphy, who once represented the area in Congress, has volunteered since 2003. He says if Stand Down must move, he hopes it will remain close.
Serving two deployments after 9/11, come back from Iraq, and you know, having 19 guys that didn't come home with me always weighs on me. And part of that is a duty to make it count and do more for your brothers and sister veterans. We hope that it either remains here or somewhere else in Bucks County, because we want to be known as the most veteran-friendly county in the nation.
For WHYY News, I'm Kyrie Greenberg.
It's another sign of the season to come. Friday marks the arrival of the harvest moon. Let's turn the page with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, you know I've been resistant to bidding adieu to summer, but let's have at it.
We have no alternative. There's nothing we can do. Time marches on. September 22nd is the day this year when we shift from summer to fall. It's the point at which the sun, as it appears in the sky during the day, stands directly above the equator at noon. And so from this point on, for Northern Hemisphere observers, that high noon position will be lower and lower in the sky until we come to the winter solstice around December 21st. The harvest moon, though, is a great indicator of what time of season it is, and certainly has been used by agriculturalists for hundreds of years, if not millennia, to identify this particular season.
Is the harvest moon always a penumbral moon?
It is not. It just so happens that the orbital mechanics and geometry of the Earth-Sun-Moon system happen to be such that there is a penumbral eclipse, an eclipse of the moon by the Earth, in which the moon appears to pass through the weakest portion of the Earth's shadow. So in a penumbral eclipse, as opposed to an umbral eclipse, there's very little color to be seen, if any at all. It's very slight, scant, almost imperceptible. And to top it all off, for those of us here in the Western Hemisphere, it's completely invisible anyway, because the event actually takes place and is visible to all those that are in the Indian Ocean or the regions immediately surrounding the Indian Ocean.
So what are the visible events in the night sky this evening and this week?
Well, there's really great stuff. We still have marvelous planets in the southwestern sky after sunset. Mars and Saturn have been performing marvelously since late spring and will continue to do so on into the early fall. But joining them is the brilliant planet Venus, raising up above the western horizon. It's now a good almost 10 degrees above the western horizon and visible if you have a clear view with no clouds or anything like that.
Let's pay tribute to those brave men and women who've been raising up above the horizon again and again and again.
Just last week, three astronauts returned from a stint aboard International Space Station. Two Russian cosmonauts, Oleg Skripochka and Alexei Ovchinin, returned along with their American companion, Jeff Williams. In this last mission for Jeff, which lasted 172 days, he now has the American record for time off planet. Altogether, 534 days in space. Now, it's broken up over four missions, but it's longer than any other American has spent time in space. The closest to him is Peggy Whitson. And Peggy, by the end of her next mission, which ends next April, she will be just 3 days shy of this record. She'll be at 531 days. But that's not the all-time record of any astronaut by a long shot. That record is held by Russian cosmonaut Gennady Padalka, who has been in space for a total of 878 days over a number of missions.
Back to those 172 consecutive day missions, that still wouldn't get you from Earth to Mars.
Oh, no, that would not. And that's the reason why these missions aboard International Space Station are really very important, because any trip that we can conceive of going to Mars now at the rates at which we can travel, 6 to 9 months is the length of time it's going to take us to get there. Gosh, we wish it could be 6 months. You know, if we decide to spend any time there on the surface of the planet at all, it becomes a multi-year mission. Multi-year mission.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Fitz, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
You find